Good morning, everybody. My name is Peter Reiling, Executive Vice President here at the Aspen Institute. We're off to another great start here in this wonderful thing called the Aspen Ideas Festival. With thanks to our sponsors for this session, Booz Allen Hamilton, I'd like to welcome you to what I think will prove to be a fascinating discussion on China and India, what's in store. A theme, of course, we touched on last year during the Ideas Festival, and you can't help but pick up on again and again. My role is simply to welcome you and to introduce our moderator for this session, Chris Kelly, Vice President from Booz Allen Hamilton, 20 years with the firm, with a long focus on risk issues. Over to you. Thank you.
Thanks. Good morning, everybody, and it's really a pleasure to be here. I think as we can see from the first session just a moment ago, that the issue of China and India and the role that they play have a major impact on the future of the way that the world is going to work. And I'm very pleased to be able to be here with this distinguished panel, because I think we're going to be able to uncover and begin to understand the differences, the similarities, and the challenges that these two countries face and also bring to the global environment, as well as the opportunity and what's in store and what's next and what's beyond the horizon, because there's so much going on in terms of technology and manufacturing and education. So there's a lot of interesting pluses and minuses that I think this panel is very well suited to discuss. So we're certainly looking forward to it. Our format this morning is about an hour and a half. We'll probably go to anywhere around 11:45, a little bit before 12. We got a little extra leeway because the previous session ran over. I'm going to introduce the panelists, give them an opportunity to speak for 5 to 7 minutes. Then we'll kind of go back and forth, a little bit of a dialogue and exchange. And then we'll open it up for the conversation to extend into the entire room so that we can all participate in an opportunity to kind of understand what's in store. So with that, let me introduce our panel from my right to the end. First is Orville Schell. Dr. Schell is currently the Dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at University of California, Berkeley. From his academic years to his latest work on China, Hong Kong, Tibet, and the media, Dr. Schell has devoted his professional life to reporting and writing about Asia. He has more than 14 books under his wing, and 9 of them on China. Very astute and insightful scholar. Next to Orville is Liz Economy. Dr. Economy is a CB Star Senior Fellow and Director for Asian Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She has published widely on both Chinese domestic and foreign policy issues. Her most recent book, The River Runs Black, The Environmental Challenge to China's Future, was named one of the top 10 books of 2004 by The Globalist and won the International Convention on Asia Studies Scholars Award for one of the best social sciences book published on Asia in 2003 and 2004. Next to her, we have Shashi Tharoor. Of course, Dr. Tharoor has a long and distinguished career at the UN, and yesterday I thought it was very interesting. He was introduced during the Big Ten session as one of the primary voices of the UN and the great communication channel there. His work is a combination of not just looking at the UN, but also the UN operations around the world, and peacekeeping is very involved in the activities worldwide. I'm very pleased to say that he's been nominated by India as a candidate for the position of UN Secretary General. And to Sashi's right is Miles Rubin, a graduate of Stanford Law School, who has served for more than 50 years as a corporate attorney specializing in mergers, acquisitions, reorganizations, and international law. He's been a chief executive and leader in a number of corporations and active in a lot of development projects in Indonesia, Israel, and China. And his current role is chairman of Miles Automotive Group, where they are developing electric cars in China for export into the U.S. and European markets. So we're going to hear some interesting things about technology innovation around what's in store for us with respect to China. So let me just open it up with Orville, who's agreed to kind of lay out an understanding of these two countries for us, because as we've heard in the previous session, these two countries play a huge role in our future. And we think it's very important that we have a common understanding of what they're all about.
Well, welcome to you all. You know, it's interesting. Depending on how you look at China and India, and people are constantly looking at them, you see very different things. And I want to sort of caution you at the outset, if some of you are confused by whether India is going to be a boom or a bust, or China ultimately a boom or a bust, I want to reassure you that you're not alone, that readers of tea leaves don't have a really decisive answer on that. And if you read the New York Times yesterday, the piece by Pankaj Mishra, India looks like rather a basket case. If you read Foreign Affairs, you get a very different view. There was a whole cover story in The Economist of will India fly? And, of course, China, you get many scenarios, some very roseate and some much less so. So this is sort of why we're here now, is to help you kind of parse through this question of how do you look at these two countries, which on the one hand are so incredibly dynamic and have entered onto the world stage with so much energy and from a certain perspective, so much hope. But there's a dark side to this, and there are lots and lots of question marks. And there may be a paradox in the end that these miraculous sort of development agendas that China and India have set out for themselves could be, in the short run, successful, but in the long run, have some real drawbacks. One which we'll talk about tomorrow in regard to China, but is always a hum in the background, is, of course, the environment, the whole question of resources. So you do have to, in trying to decide of whether these countries, what their futures are, you have to look at short-term, long-term. And there are many things that aren't factored into the economic equation of success. Maybe we can do a little of that here today. Miles has got an electronic car venture, which is very interesting, that cars being made in China. Now, I thought it would be helpful just to start. And let's just look at this as something of a preliminary list, and maybe my colleagues will add to it as we go along. If you quickly go down a list of what's similar about India and China, and then you go down another list of what are the dissimilar features, this may help you kind of get compartments in your head into which you can drop other facts and ideas as we proceed with this session. So let's start with the similarities. Obviously, China and India both have huge populations, over a billion people. India, just over a billion. China, hovering around 1.3 billion. Interesting to note, though, that the margin of error in China for population counting is the entire population of France, just to set things in perspective. Both have, you know, they're relatively large land masses, but compared to population, in China's case, it's about a quarter of the world's population with 7% of the arable land. That's a tough ratio. And India is comparable. Both countries don't have a lot of natural resources. You know, they're not rich in oil. One thing they do have is coal, and we'll maybe get into that in a little bit. But they do have massive growing power needs. It's interesting. China has 957 million tons of coal need compared to the U.S. It's 564 million. India is 205. But both of these figures are climbing at alarming rates, and the only place they can really turn, besides imported oil, which is primarily used for power, is coal. So coal is going to be big in the future of both of these countries for a long time, and you all know the consequences of coal. Increasing reliance on imported petroleum. Both are committed to renewable energy, but realistically speaking, this will be a small percentage of their developmental futures. Nuclear, even smaller. Both countries are building 20-odd plants, have at least designed, but still it'll be a minuscule portion of the total power need. Both are self-sufficient, more or less, at this point in food. That's an interesting fact. They both have fairly good systems, at least of higher education. The primary education is another question. Both have rather notable and commendable rates of growth. China, 9% plus. India, over the past 3 years, 8% plus. That's not bad. Given some of the states of growth in other developed countries. both have rather ponderous and difficult bureaucracies. It's not easy to get stuff done in either of these countries. Both also have a growing, and I think quite alarming, rich-poor divide, which does mean that there are some fracture points that really have to be watched in terms of social stability in the future. This is a problem worldwide. Now, there are many other similarities. These are just a few to start you off. Let's look at some of the differences. India has a very long tradition of English speaking, great advantage. China, quite astoundingly, is learning English at an amazing rate. I think all of you who've been there would agree, but still it doesn't have the tradition of English being a second language, at least for educated people. India's history, very different than China. It was a colony. China, you could say, was a kind of a quasi-colony. But what's interesting about that fact is that I think actually China has a great deal more sort of unresolved issues about exploitation, colonialism, the outside world, predatory Western powers, Japan, than India. It's rather ironic that you'd think that the country that had been colonialized would be much more sort of actively involved in sort of anti-Western sentiment. But it turns out to be not to be the case. They have a different relationship to the U.S. and Europe. In India's case, it's rather matter of fact. China has a constantly sort of agitated state of love, hate, rapprochement, or separation from the United States. It's a very interesting, very complicated, and very deep relationship. India had no communist revolution. It did have a colonial liberation, but it was, in terms of social, economic, and political upheaval, it was nothing compared to what China went through in the second half of the 20th century. That's a huge difference. There's a huge difference in the nature of the governments of each of these countries. And what's notable about that, I think, is that China is a very tightly wound political system. And it is a system of control. Whereas India is a system, states are very powerful, you have communist governments in some, not in others. India, it seems to me, can contain almost any kind of a explosion, social, political, economic, and it hardly seems to bat an eye. And that's maybe a virtue. Whereas China, if there's anything of major sort of tectonic proportions, it's a big deal. So there's a huge difference in what each of these governments and societies can absorb in certain terms of instability. China is getting to have an amazing infrastructure. I was there a few weeks ago driving on the freeways of China. I mean, it is, for someone who came into this country, you know, in the mid-70s when there wasn't a mile of freeway anywhere, it's astounding. Ports, airports, urban facilities of one kind or another, railroads, it's quite amazing. India is still a bit more retrograde in its infrastructural development, and this is going to be a huge problem. Now, finally, let me just say one thing. It's common, I think, for most of us to think of China, which I obviously know much better than India, to think that ultimately as it develops, economically first perhaps, opening up, being marketized, ultimately political liberalization will follow. That's a kind of a standard political science presumption. But I want to just leave you with this thought. It may be that actually China is where it's going. A political system relatively closed, institutions borrowed from Stalin's Russia in the 50s, they still continue on, economically increasingly open to the world, but the strange sort of divided contradiction between economics and politics. And it may be that they've actually stumbled upon, without quite knowing it, some new kind of quite successful model for development, which is a very authoritarian political system and a very open marketized economy. And this is something that you see people like Putin ogling now and thinking, this is not bad. You know, maybe we should try a little of this. cuts down on the demonstrations, the instability, all of the problems which you are well acquainted with. So it may be that China is more or less where it wants to get, and that development from here on in will be largely on the economic side, with very little changes in the political structure, which is in fact what we have seen over the last decade. So finally, I would say, try to remember as you look at these countries, particularly China, there is no answer as to whether it's going to succeed or fail. Both of these potentialities are inherent in the proposition of this most unresolved of countries. And it could go in either way, or anywhere in between. And again, as I said at the beginning, as you sort of twist this crystal of each of these countries, depending on how you look at it, you see very different things. You can get very gloomy, and you can say, how could this possibly cohere? On the other hand, you could say, this is amazing. This is truly a miracle unequaled in any time in human history in terms of human development and bringing people up the food chain from poor to less poor. So this is a contradiction, finally, and I think that's probably where we will leave it at the end of this session.
Excellent. Thanks, Orville. Liz, now take us into China. Talk about some of the issues maybe that Orville raised and provide us your perspective. I saw you smiling during some of that on what you see is what's in store.
Okay, great. I mean, I think Orville did a terrific job of sort of setting out the landscape of China and India and sort of what are the challenges in some respects that both countries face moving forward. I think you ended in a place I never would have anticipated that you would end, which sort of the idea that China may remain pretty much where it is politically, and I hope we have some time to talk about that. But I thought what I'd do is just really talk about three sets of challenges, or if you're a kind of glass half full person, opportunities perhaps that China's rise poses for the rest of the world. And I guess the first group that I would set out of issues really are what I would term the unintended consequences of China's rise, simply by the fact that China has been growing at a rate of 9 to 10% per year over the past two decades. And is a country of 1.3 billion people. And because of its system of governance, which, while tightly wound, as Orville said, and highly authoritarian, is also incredibly decentralized and corrupt. So when you combine these three factors, I think you have a country that really has the opportunity to affect much of the world much more broadly and more deeply than most others. And just to give you a couple of examples, take the environment. China is now the second largest contributor to global climate change after the United States, likely to surpass us in maybe 15 years, maybe fewer than that. It is the largest contributor to ozone depletion, the largest now polluter of the Pacific, incredibly, because a decade ago it was nowhere on the horizon in that regard. It is also the largest importer of illegally logged timber. So clearly how China grows, how it manages its environment is going to have a profound impact on the global environment. If you look at public health, I think we've seen over the past 3 years that China has the potential to be a repository for a global health pandemic, whether SARS or avian flu. I just got an email yesterday from a friend and colleague of mine, Lori Garrett, who is renowned in the world of global public health. And she said she's been tracking that there have been 13, over the past several months, 13 major outbreaks of influenza in China, the last one just now over the past month in Guangdong. Now, maybe, and sending many people to hospitals and this kind of thing, maybe it's just the flu, and maybe it's not. But given the state of China's public health system, and given the lack of transparency and openness still within China's political system, what do we really know about what's going on in terms of these flu outbreaks? Again, a sort of a second challenge, I think, unintended, but a combination of these sort of factors that I set out. And third, I guess I'd look at China's labor. Right, you have 1.3 billion people entering a globalized labor market. Clearly, there's going to be an impact, whether you're talking about the construction industry in South Africa, global textile market, the motorcycle industry in Thailand, whatever it is, China is going to have an impact, not to mention the positive impact, of course, of all those low-cost goods. So again, I think these are unintended consequences. They're not ways in which China has sought to shape the global political system, yet it has and will continue to do so simply because of its size and governance and growth. The second, I guess, is more intended, and in some ways more troublesome, I think, and that is simply the way that China goes about doing business. And again, I think over the past 3 to 5 years, we've seen that China has served as an engine of growth for much of the rest of the world. Whether you're looking at China as a market for Japan and South Korea, China is now their number one trading partner, big market for their goods, or, and I think somewhat more importantly, if you're looking at Chinese investment overseas now, slightly over 50% of China's direct investment overseas goes into natural resource extraction, minerals, timber, oil and gas. And this, again, has been very important for the developing world. In Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, we see China going in very deeply into countries where they haven't been before. And again, serving as an engine of growth. At the same time, I think it raises some challenges. For example, China's safety, labor practices, environmental practices, look at the mining industry, pretty much rank at the bottom of the world. So we have to ask the question, as China goes out abroad seeking resources, is it in essence exporting worst practices? And I think there's some evidence when we're looking at China and Peru and other places that in fact that is what's happening. I think too, when China goes abroad, it does so in a very positive way. The Chinese government has a sort of a win-win mantra, right? There's no state-owned enterprise that simply goes and does a deal to invest in a mine in Zambia or to develop oil in Angola. These companies bring the full weight of the Chinese government behind them. That means potentially hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars of promised infrastructure assistance. And so you find tens of thousands of Chinese workers in these countries, building ports and dams and telecommunications infrastructure. You see science and technology cooperative agreements. You see training for doctors and nurses, all sorts of positive impacts. At the same time, China's other mantra is we don't mix business with politics. And this can in some ways be more troublesome. So that I was at a conference in South Africa, I guess it was late last fall, and there was a person from Namibia talking about how you can trace the foreign assistance from every country through the Namibian national budget, except for that coming from China. They have no idea where that money is going and where it's being funneled to. Or you can look at the case of Angola, where the IMF, the EU, the United States, was trying to use the promise of a substantial loan to bring about some improvement in transparency and governance in Angola. And the Chinese simply walked in the door and said, never mind that. Here's the money, no strings, no political strings attached. So I think, and you can talk to people in NEPAD, which is the African organization devoted to promoting good governance, and they will say, quietly, because frankly, nobody is willing to call the kettle black when it comes to China. They will say, frankly, China is a problem for us. So the fact that China is willing to do deals potentially in corrupt ways with governments that themselves may be corrupt and weak in governance, I think, is challenging. And last on this point, I guess I'd raise the issue that I think it's a very positive step that we've seen China in the United Nations over the past probably 5 years, 7 years, become a far more active, proactive, engaged player. And, we opened the door to China to host the six-party talks on North Korea. This was an important step, I think, for them. And we see them now in Iran and Sudan and other places where they're playing such an important role. And the question is, how do we get them to play the really positive role that we might want them to play in improving the situation? Again, going back to this idea of not mixing business with politics, of course, there's no such thing. But how do we get China to use its growing economic influence in a lot of these troubled areas to a positive outcome? And let me just finish by making raising the other set of issues. I don't want to go too far over my time, but I think they're precisely what Orville raised, and that is the issues that speak to the transition that's taking place within China and the reform process and the uncertainty inherent in that process. I think today with Hu Jintao and Wang Jiabao as the leaders of China, we have a fundamentally different leadership than we've had with Deng Xiaoping and Jiang Zemin. And that is to say, for Deng and Jiang, I think they were overwhelmingly willing to see sort of go-go economic growth at all costs. And paid little attention to anything else. And for Jiang Zemin, you know, China hit the apex in 2001, you know, joined the WTO, won the Olympics bid, hosted APEC. It was a banner year. And then Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao come in, and they see something relatively different. I think they see the dark side that Orwell was alluding to of Chinese economic growth, and that is whether you have an environment that is so degraded and polluted that it's, you know, biting back into the economy now, you know, at a, you know, 8 to 12% of, you know, GDP annually, and, you know, we can talk at length about that, but we're going to do that tomorrow anyway. Or you're talking about the public health system, the entire social welfare net that is basically non-existent in this, quote, socialist country. Or you talk about the social unrest, which last year was at 87,000 protests. And we're not talking 10 people walking down the street with placards. We're talking, in some instances, 100,000 people in Sichuan province protesting the fact that this dam is being built and they're not compensated for their land. Or we're talking 30 to 40,000 people in Zhejiang province protesting the fact, and these protests turn violent, protesting the fact that these polluting factories are making them sick and you know, polluting their air, ruining their crops, and they can't get redress for 2 years. So these are the kinds of challenges I think that Hu and Wen see. And then we don't even get into the issue of transparency and governance and NGOs and stuff, but I hope we have some chance to do that. But I think these are the challenges that they see. But frankly, I think they are not prepared to take the steps necessary in terms of developing official accountability and openness and transparency that they're that they need to do. So I'll end there.
Thanks, Liz. Sashi, take us now to India.
Right. Well, I must say I enjoyed Liz on China and thinking of the points that Orwell made, laying out the differences. I was struck also by where he ended, the point about where China is going as a, as you say, an autocratic system with an open economy, and you mentioned Moscow keeping an eye on it. It sort of is, it just seems to be a perestroika without glasnost, is what the Chinese have pulled off. And it's a curious thing because, of course, in India you have lots of glasnost and hardly any perestroika. So it's sort of the...
They ought to get married.
The opposite, yeah, exactly. Maybe they will. That may be where they're heading. What can I say about India? I mean, the fact is that it is an extraordinarily diverse country, and that is perhaps the key to understanding India and its transformations today. There have been allusions to that by both Orwell and Liz. The fact is that you have a country which has such enormous variety of every kind, ethnic, linguistic, religious, regional, and so on, but which is held together precisely by the fact of its democratic and federal political system. So that, as Orwell pointed out, it can contain a great deal. I mean, India's had every kind of unrest imaginable, including actively armed and financed secessionist movements, and somehow India has absorbed all of them. Yesterday's secessionists are today's chief ministers and tomorrow's opposition leaders because they get co-opted into the process of the ballot. But this diversity does have some interesting ramifications, one of which, particularly in recent years, has been the extent to which the federal government, which in India is actually more powerful than the constitution suggests, has gradually become taken over by the states. What's happening is we no longer seem to have a situation in which one political party will be able to run, to command a majority by itself in parliament. So right now we have a coalition government of 23 parties, which has replaced a coalition government of 32 parties. And the last coalition government had a stable five-year term, despite having so many parties. This one looks very much on course for fulfilling most of its elected five-year term. So there is a certain political stability. But what this means, though, is that these parties that make up the coalition are parties that are strong in their states. And India has 28 states and a number of union territories. And therefore, the interests of the states and what may be seen as essentially regional or parochial interests tend to have far more weight in the capital, in Delhi, than used to be the case in the past. And the kind of India of the grand national vision, particularly epitomized in figures like Nehru, India's first prime minister, whom I've written a biography, has been replaced by a much more coalitionist, accommodationist, cut and tack and make agreements kind of approach, which again has its own limitations. So every time that you see change and reform in India, it's very often with the hesitancy of a government looking over its electoral shoulder. Again, another fact in India is you don't just have the national elections every 5 years, you also have elections in the states, to the state assemblies. So the government in power in Delhi doesn't go through a 6 or 8 month period ever in its 5 year term where it isn't facing an election somewhere at the state level. And that too means, of course, a great deal of responsiveness to political concerns and public pressures, but it also means that change comes slowly. I think Indians have tended sometimes to use the metaphor of the elephant, you know, that the elephant, which is, of course, India's national animal, moves very slowly and turns very slowly, but once it turns, it is set on its course and cannot easily be swayed from it. So that may be the more positive way of looking at this process of slow perestroika. But there's lots of glasnost. This is a country with a thriving free press, with every conceivable political opinion allowed free play. In fact, the late British historian E.P. Thompson wrote in the 80s that India, I'm quoting here, is the most important country for the future of the world because, and he explained this, there is not a thought that is being thought in the East or the West that is not active in some Indian mind. And I'm glad a Brit said that and not an Indian. But the fact is that that does mean that you do have this extraordinary interplay of ideas, and you see it reflected in the advances India's made in intellectual development, the whole question of software, the whole question of the way in which the creative properties of the Indian intellect have manifested themselves internationally from computers and IT technology to, of course, the creative R&D in pharmaceuticals to the products of Bollywood, which are exported very successfully internationally, Indian music, Indian fashion, and now Indian literature in recent years. All of these are strengths for which I think there isn't yet a comparable equivalent in China, with some exceptions. Obviously, Chinese movies are coming up to international renown, but India, this is where India's major strength lies. Where India's strength doesn't lie is in some of the hard infrastructure, where indeed there is no question that China has a dozen airports that are better than the best looking airport in India. There is no question that a number of these things, China is far more developed. I think there's 60,000 kilometers of six-lane highways in China. India doesn't have 60 kilometers of six-lane highways. So there's simply no comparison in that sense. And the easy tendency to lump both together should be resisted. A final thought. I mean, I tend to be fairly upbeat about India, as some of you who know my writings will know. But I do worry about a couple of things. And one of them certainly relates to the fact that that we do have an interesting, perhaps positive, perhaps negative, set of demographic indicators to worry about. I think the line about China is, will China get rich before it gets old? Because with the one-child policy, you are going to have large numbers of old people 30, 40 years from now with very few youngsters to support them. In India, it's the opposite. 65% of the population is under 25, and you've got a large number of people coming into the workforce every year. In the next 5 years, there will be 71 million Indians looking for jobs. The question is India going to be able to provide them? At this stage, it's very hard to say with confidence that we are, largely because the kinds of things India is doing well are things that don't actually involve large numbers of workers. Another consideration is that India has traditionally had very restrictive labor legislation that makes it difficult to set up huge, gigantic factories and so on the way China has done. And so this is a question of worry. I said earlier on, echoing Orwell, that India will be able to absorb pretty much any sorts of political tensions. But it still is worrying because we've taken a lot of heart in the fact that the ballot box provides a way out for people. But if you keep voting out governments and getting a new set of governments that isn't going to do anything better for you, there is a danger that you might well be tempted to other forms of unrest. And lots of young people, particularly young men, without enough productive work to do in any society, is a cause for worry. So will India be able to restructure its economic approaches in a way that generates higher employment and therefore absorbs more of these people coming in? In which case, of course, having productive young people is going to mean a huge boost to the economy. Or will a failure to do that create other problems? That remains to me one of the big worrying question marks about India. But on the whole, just to finish, Orwell made the point that India hasn't had a revolution, but in a paradoxical way it has. Those of you who've been to India over the last 20 or 30 years will find unrecognizable transformations in everything, in politics, in society, caste relations, for example, in the economy, obviously. And each of these changes would have been a revolution in any other society. In India, somehow it's been a democratic, absorbed revolution. But to think, to give one example of what I meant by this, in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh, we've had an untouchable, that is a Dalit, former outcast community, woman as chief minister, the equivalent of an American governor, of the state twice in the last 5 or 6 years, something which would have been unthinkable for 3,000 years of Indian social history. Now, that isn't a revolution. You've got to find another credible world to imagine how much of a transformation that requires in popular and political attitudes. And these kinds of changes have happened through the democratic process, and that, to me, is what's most encouraging about India.
Outstanding. Thanks, Hashi. Miles, take us to the innovation and technology side and talk about the entrepreneurism and what do you see happening and the implications of that coming into the global market.
Well, first I want to say that I agree with Elizabeth about some of the concerns she has about China's future, and I could add to the concerns she enumerated issues of corruption, issues of human rights, and many others that are troubling. But I think we here in the West tend to look at China as China was, not necessarily as China is or will be. I think we have to disenthrall ourselves from much of what we knew about China 10 or 15 years ago. There have been dramatic changes in every area that are taking place, and I think the government of China is aware, painfully aware, of all of the problems that we talk about in China. And I think that government has the ability to get both the problems under control and to let the steam off slowly enough so that there is not a catastrophe, but quickly enough so that they can bring up to a much higher level, the one-third or more of the country that's living under very, very harsh circumstances. To give you an idea, I'll give you some personal experiences I've had. You mentioned automobiles and cars. One can go to China, and if you go to the wrong cities, or you don't go to the new China, you will see plants that are hard to believe. I mean, these plants go back to Henry Ford's day. I mean, antiquated, inefficient factories, many of them that formerly built military equipment, gun carriers, that are called automobile plants. But you can go to the most modern plants in the world in China, plants that far surpass anything we have. And interestingly enough, in robotics. So the thought we have that China is all about cheap labor is a thought we may have to rethink. They are thinking ahead in this area to the future, and they know that their labor rates are not going to stay where they are. In technology, China, as you know, graduates probably 4 times or 5 times as many engineers as the United States does each year. Now, at a lower level than many of our graduate schools of engineering. But still, it's an impressive number. And many of those are required, perhaps as much as two-thirds of those graduates are required for domestic projects. You talked about road construction, bridge construction. China is now building, at this time, 2 maglevs, I would say at a cost of probably a total cost of $10 billion. They plan to join up Shanghai all the way down to Hangzhou. That's a trip that takes me, when I go down to Hangzhou, about 5 hours, and I will now be able to get there in 21 minutes. By the time you get there for the Olympics, I know people say this is not possible because they've just started, you'll be able to get from Tianjin to the Olympics in 23 minutes. Which would take you probably 4 hours to do by car, 3.5 hours to 4 hours. So they're pushing ahead in infrastructure and very, very modern infrastructure. In R&D, they're starting to put more and more money into R&D. China spends very little money today in R&D compared to the U.S., which is the largest in the world in what we spend of GDP. China probably spends something in the area of, I would guess, 1-1.5% of GDP in R&D today, and that may be generous. However, as I said before, we have to disenthrall ourselves from what China was in the past, because all these numbers are moving exponentially. When we talk about China growing at 10%, my belief is that China will grow far faster than 10% going forward. I think all of these numbers are going to increase in an exponential way. I'll give you an example that may be interesting for you. China, 10 years ago, was barely in the battery business. I mean, they made flashlight batteries, and I think we used to get them and try and put the flashlight on, and sometimes it'd go on. Sometimes the Chinese flashlight wouldn't work. They've moved ahead to where today China has roughly 80% of the world's computer battery business, and that has been done in a very short time, and all in modern new industry. On the R&D side, whereas we know that the future of electric vehicles is going to rest on technologies like lithium-ion technology, and whereas we talk about it a lot here, China has pushed ahead so that today, as we sit here, they are actually producing lithium-ion powertrains to propel vehicles running from 300 to 360 volts, and doing it at a price that my friends here in industry say are impossible. And they haven't done this just with human power. It's not like they took a lot of Chinese and put them to work on lithium, making lithium-ion batteries. These are automated plants by and far. So that my own personal experience, I've been in China, the car business is something recent. I've done business in China for many years. And I've always been amazed at their ability, once they take a project on, to see it through quickly, efficiently to the end. And even if at the beginning of the project they're not well acquainted with it, you might say, what are they doing in this area? They get up to speed. They get tremendous government support. When you do business in China, you're doing business with the government. You may think you're doing business with a private enterprise. You look at a battery company you're doing business with. It's owned by the local banks or by the major banks in many cases, by the city where the industry is located, and often directly by the Chinese government. In important areas that will relate to their future, the Chinese government has kept a lot of interest and power. As an example, the entire process of certifying industrial equipment and automotive equipment is directly in the hands of the Chinese government. Not just setting the standards, but running the institutions that do the testing that generate the profit. So I have a very, very positive view of China's future. At the same time, of its future. At the same time, I have great fears, as I think we all do, of how this might go astray. I'm going to hit corruption briefly, because as you pick up the papers, you keep reading about corruption in China. And I'd like to make the suggestion that it may not be as pervasive as people say it is. Or at least, if it is pervasive, it is at a fairly low level. I'd like to also remind everybody that it was the United States that found it necessary a number of years ago to enact the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act because of the practices of our corporations. So corruption is not unique to China, but let's see what they're doing about it. And in China, there's a two-track approach. The party has its own anti-corruption policies and practices, as does the government apart from the party. By that I mean, if someone is accused of corruption and is a party member, they go through a double track of investigation. And if either one of the investigatory bodies find that there is corruption, it's then referred up to the authorities. The Chinese publish, and you can all get it. By the way, I think you can get it on the web. But they publish a quarterly digest of corruption in China, in which they report every case of corruption, no matter how big or small, what the process is, what the disposition of the case is. Some people say, well, that's only a small part of it. I mean, you're only seeing the people who were caught. You're not seeing the clever ones who got away. But I think I'm using this just as an example of that when the government gets onto something, they follow through on it. Human rights. There's been a huge change in China on human rights. I mean, anyone who went there for 20, 50, 10 years ago, 3 years ago, when you go there, you see there's a dramatic change. Things that do concern me are continuing restrictions on access to information, particularly broadband and internet. But even there, you can see the hard hand of the government relaxing somewhat. As an example, in Shanghai, you cannot have a dish to pick up signals, to pick up TV or digital signals without getting a permit. And when you go to Shanghai, there is not a single residence that doesn't have a dish virtually. I mean, it's like a sea of dishes. And yet when you check into it, you see that very few of those people have ever applied for a permit. Takes too long, costs too much. So there's far more access to the outside world than you think. And for young people particularly, they can get access through I'm talking about the major cities, through the universities, through the places where they work. Because every office in China is now hooked up. It's on the internet. And as the young people come in the morning, I know they do it in our offices in Shanghai, they actually come in a half hour or more early to get on the internet and to see what's going on in the world. And there is very, very little censorship at that level. So in short, I think in technology, they're going to surprise us. They will put more and more money into R&D, and they're going to start producing different products. The Chinese are getting ready to send cars to the United States, and here's what they're doing. And this is the way they approach many things. Costco, the Chinese Overseas Shipping Company, which is an agency of the government, is now building 8 massive roll-on, roll-off cars capable of handling 7,500 cars in a shot that will make a 10 to 11-day trip to the West Coast. So I assume they're not building those to move the cars from Tianjin to Dalian. Their plan is to move product to the West. And they are upgrading all of their facilities to meet NHTSA requirements and working closely with the Department of Transportation in the United States to get ready to do that. Now, people say that'll be 10 years, and I say it'll probably be two or three or most 4 years.
Miles, let me pick up on some of the dialogue we've had then and turn to the one question I think we have to actually address, which is the one that Orville threw out there. And this whole idea that this form of government is actually the new model, I thought was surprising as well. I think you need to explain it a little bit, and I think we need to talk about it.
Well, what I mean by that is not that nothing will change, and it's perfectly possible that this new model will not be able to cohere. But I do think that this is a new and interesting kind of developmental moment where this idea of a very sort of tightly run political entity sitting on top of a very loosely run economy is a new pioneering model that is all China's. And I think it has a lot of appeal for countries. I mean, look around Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, countries that have lived in chaos for decades. And social stability is an absolute prerequisite for economic development, and it's very tempting. So I'm not saying that there won't be any changes in China, because I think China is so delicately balanced in so many different ways. It could fall off the wire at any moment in 5 different directions. But I think that's the aspiration of the leaders right now, is to kind of keep politics relatively in a relatively slow state of evolution and let economics go. Listen, vis-a-vis the internet, I just wanted to say one thing. I think one of the things that India does have, Indian media is not always great, as you well know, but it is certainly open. India has a very open internet too, whereas China has thrown huge amounts of resources into censoring the internet through the gateways into China. They've even got Google in a hammer lock, Microsoft, Yahoo. I mean, this is a huge issue right now. These companies that are iconic in their representations to the world of being free and open and transparent go into China, and they're getting their wings clipped. And they're very upset, they're very disturbed, and they're trying to figure out how do you get into this big market and not compromise your brand. So this is an incomparable advantage, in my view, to India, because information is the new blood in the circulatory system of the globe. And China has a very ambivalent attitude towards it.
Liz, perspective?
Yeah, I guess, sort of picking up on what Miles was talking about having to do with corruption, and maybe it's not as severe a problem as some people make it out to be. I think a lot of the way that you understand China has to do with where you intersect with the country. And I found this a lot in my work at the council, where we have a lot of investment bankers, of which my husband is one, so I can talk about them, I think, without being pejorative. But, they can come in and fly into, the airport in Pudong, and then they get in their car, and then they go to the Grand Hyatt, and then they go to their meetings, and then they go back to the Grand Hyatt, and then they fly out again. And that is one level of understanding of China. Since I tend to operate at a low level, I mean, it doesn't mean I don't ever meet with foreign ministry people and that kind of thing, I do, but I work a lot at grassroots and with NGOs, environmental activists and stuff. I think if you look down at the ground, you're probably hard-pressed to find a village, a county, a town, a municipality where corruption is not endemic. They just booted the vice mayor of Beijing, who was in charge of the Olympics, for God's sakes, for graft. But beyond that, when I was just in China, again, probably same time you were, Orville, just about 2 weeks ago, I was in the German ambassador's residence to have lunch with him, and he was right in the midst of dealing with this issue, which some of you may be familiar with, where there was a dam activist who'd appeared in a German film talking again about how this is for the Three Gorges Dam, hadn't been compensated, and there's a whole film on this. But he was one that was identifiable by the local government there. And what do you know? He's beaten up by thugs to the point that he's paralyzed, right, from the neck down. He's in a local hospital. And the Chinese doctor there is willing to let the German doctor, so the German ambassador sent the doctor and some other people there, willing to let the doctor look at the x-rays, because they didn't know what to do. They weren't equipped. They didn't know, could we treat him, could we not, whatever. And then the local foreign affairs officer said, no, we're not going to let you look at these x-rays, and we're not going to let you have anything to do with this. Meantime, the foreign ministry spokesperson is talking about how this person is getting all the medical treatment that is necessary. You don't need to worry about anything. You have the winner of the Goldman Environmental Prize this year, who is Chinese, based in Yunnan, who was placed under house arrest by the Yunnan government. Why? Because he is a man who is taking villagers from one proposed dam site to one where a dam had already been built to show them that actually all is not cut out to be. You may not benefit as much as all these local authorities are telling you you're going to. So, I could go on and on about the level of corruption, about how, at the local level, there are these, fees for education, people, increasing numbers of girls can't go to school in rural areas. At every level, whether you're talking about intellectual property rights, whether you're talking about bank loans, virtually any issue area that has to do with China's agreement to international treaties or even enforcement of its own laws, corruption is pervasive. So I guess I have quite a different view, I think, than Miles. And in terms of the Chinese government going after that, I would simply suggest it is impossible for the Chinese government to pluck out every single corrupt official within China. They need a different system of accountability.
Well, I'm not here to defend the status of corruption in China, other than to say, as I said about human rights, I do see changes. I'll tell you an interesting thing, and of course it has to do with China's love of capitalism and of money and of the economy. In most countries in the world, when you want to export from that country, it's not an easy process, including Europe. There are all sorts of roadblocks. And this would be a very easy place to find corruption in China. I assure you, Elizabeth, that there is not 30 seconds wasted in any port in China in having to move product out or having to do paperwork. And that's a place I would expect to find it. Everything moves right through. The paperwork is like that. There are no officials, and I think I would know this, because, by the way, I don't only make cars in China. I made lots of products in China, and have moved them out. There is not, I've never seen a single instance, and I'm sure I would know about it. And the people who work for me, the Chinese, could not be hiding this, where they've ever been asked by an official for a bribe in order to export product. I think there are areas where, you know, where it is bad. But I think it's easy to beat up on China. The Chinese see themselves very differently than we see them. They see themselves as the survivors of a great, great empire. You know, we talked about India and how they see themselves. The Chinese, and I think this really is ingrained in them, see themselves as having once dominated the world, and they see themselves going back to that position again. Mm-hmm. And again, comparing it to India, I'd say that language is a problem, but when you think that in the big cities now, kindergarten requires English. In China, children in kindergarten are learning English. They're moving it up. Where they see a problem, engineering. Their engineers are not really well enough trained. They will bring in engineers from the outside. One other thing about China comparing it to India. India does have some... there is a savings virtue in India, but nothing compared to China. China saves the average household, or the households in China, save 20% of their income. I think it's 25% now. It's been going up. So we live in a country where there's a negative saving rate.
Right.
China has a 25% saving rate. Why? And I'll tell you why I think that's important. I think many of these problems will end up getting solved as China evolves its taxation system and as people are forced to save less to take care of themselves. So, health is very poor in China compared to some countries. Access is there, but the system isn't good. But they have the savings to fall back on. China is growing this old population. Who's going to take care of them? China, fortunately, has a well-knit family unit. The families stay together and hang together. And older people like me are venerated in China.
It's interesting, Miles. When I listened to the two of you discuss this, all of the areas where it seems to, quote-unquote, work are aligned with the growth and production of goods and the export and delivery of services worldwide. And all of the things that are not working are about people and society and the growth of the individual over time. So that contrast actually was interesting to come out of the conversation, and you wonder just how long that can go on. Before we start to open up for questions from the group, feel free. There's microphones on either side, and we can open up discussion to the audience. Mitch, please identify yourself.
Sure. I'm Seth Green, and I'm with a group of Americans for Informed Democracy. I really enjoyed the panelists. I know the topic is what's in store for China and India, but I'm curious what your views are on kind of the future of U.S. relations, especially with China. And here's, I guess, my concern. I hear a lot from you all about China. It gives a really comprehensive view. To be honest, I hear very little in our media about China. The only time, really, is when I mistakenly pass by Lou Dobbs' show. And I say that because that is really the type of China that Americans see, and it's a very small part. And it's, in my opinion, regardless of what you think about rights or those things, it's just a dishonest picture in terms of how they're taking our jobs, because I don't see the economy working that way. And I guess my question to you all is, how do we prepare as a country? China is rising even more suddenly than I think many of us expect. And there are a lot of things that we're not really talking about. There's an interesting report that in 2005, we consumed 71% of our GDP, And the Chinese consumed 42% of their GDP because they reinvested all of these resources. And there are a lot of other, you know, questions out there about what America should be doing. And
it's
I don't
good
feel
question,
like they're
Seth.
Yeah, really getting asked. And I wonder what you think we should do to prepare as a country in our education system and in our resources.
Liz, you want to take a shot?
Yeah, I thought you were going in a slightly different direction. Let me offer one thing, and then maybe Miles and Orville want to say something else. And that is that I think up until about a year ago, we weren't really focused on the full range of, you know, potential challenges that China was going to pose. I do think that that Bob Zelik, really the deputy, former now, I guess, deputy secretary of state, began to articulate a way of thinking about China and a way of dealing with China that was important. And that was really a sort of this responsible stakeholder framework. What was missing from his sort of overview was the sense that we need to be more responsible stakeholders in the international system. But I think on the China side of it, I think he about got it right. But I think there are a lot of people now talking about the educational issue. Who's it, Craig Barrett? And we have all these councils on competitiveness and all these sorts of people talking a lot about what the United States needs to do in order to stay competitive. I do think it's interesting that we hosted at the council Li Yuanqiao, who is the party secretary from Jiangsu province, which is, I don't know, what is the second largest, wealthiest province in China, something like that. And he came. He was unbelievable, dynamic, incredible guy. The mission that he had in visiting, though, was to find American universities to come to China, business schools and engineering and tech, right? Not interested in the social sciences and the arts, this kind of thing, but to have them come and establish campuses in Jiangsu to train Chinese. So I think that as they are going out and seeking, you know, sort of input from us, I think it's probably important that we're thinking about, yes, what are we doing here also to stay competitive? And it applies to a range of areas, whether you're looking at energy efficiency and all sorts of things where I think that they have a vision and that our vision may be a step or two behind them. I think you're right.
Other perspectives, Orville?
Well, I think it's worth remembering the American society and political system is very different from China. I mean, we often forget that China is a Leninist dominated single party state, and so there are going to be contradictions, and we do have a very complex relationship with China. I think the challenge is to try to help facilitate as much evolution away from that model in China as possible without being overweening, without being arrogant, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, we get drilling away on the problems often. But I think it would be behoovous to look at those areas where there's a natural overlap. In other words, where China really does want some help, doesn't want just our preaching and moralizing, which it's fine and we should do it, but we need to have a little moral currency when we do it. Now, one area that I happen to think is absolutely critical is the environment. I mean, these two countries, India and China, are going like a train on fire down the tracks. And they are literally incinerating themselves in the process. They know it. The leadership in China, the high leadership, is quite enlightened on this subject. What can they do about it? Well, they have a limited capacity to articulate policies and laws down at the provincial and county level. But this would be a wonderful area where if the United States would team up with China, we might build up some cushion, some fund of sort of collaborative energy so that when we come to these other issues, then we have a little bit of a reserve, some flotation under us to entitle us to weigh in on these other issues, whether it's human rights or the internet or trade or you name it. They're important. They shouldn't be forgotten in this whole equation, but neither should the costs of this hellacious development, which we see, which we esteem, which we're making money on ourselves. We're in Walmart. Listen, Walmart is wall to wall. What we've done is we've exported all the toxic waste, all the smoke, all the exhaust, you name it, it's in China, and we're shopping in Walmart. Now, it seems to me there might be some overlap here to the United States with its high levels of technology, sophistication, education to go in and to have some project to right that imbalance.
Let's try it from the other side of the room.
I run FXB International. There's another similarity, it seems to me, between India and China, which is a very wide and worrying, fast-growing AIDS epidemic that is completely ignored in both countries. And in India, there have been studies that state that India has a 0.9 national prevalence of AIDS. And the World Bank has had made studies previously which states that at 1%, a country is at a great danger. It doubles every year after that, and the country is at great danger of losing every year 1% of its GDP. So I would just... And China, we haven't got a clue. And with all due respect to Mr. Rubin's views on the Chinese and the human rights, if we apply to China the inextricable link between health and human rights, to apply it to their political system, I mean, we can be extremely worried, in my opinion. So I'd like to have the views of the panel on that double threat in the region.
Well, I mean, I think she's absolutely right about the importance of this issue, no question about it. And one of the important things we've seen happening, fortunately, is that there's much less denial than there used to be. One of the big problems with the onset and spread of AIDS, not just in Asia but in Africa too, was the initial reluctance of national leaders to deal with the phenomenon of AIDS. Either they didn't want to know about it, they said it wasn't their business, or they said, well, this is not an eye. Our people don't behave like this, it doesn't happen to us. This sort of nonsense. And that's gone now. There's much more willingness to face it. I'm not competent to talk about how China is dealing with it, but certainly in India, one important and encouraging sign has been the multiplication of NGOs that have gone into this area, and I guess yours is one, Albina, but for example, the Gates Foundation has set up an AIDS-related NGO in India called Avahan, which is doing a lot of work, and there are others. And that may be one area in which the openness of Indian society to action by all sorts of actors, not just reliance on governmental and state structures, because we all know the limitations of the public health system, may offer some hope. But I agree with you, it's very serious. We can't deny it. We have to worry about things like the social opprobrium that's inflicted on victims of AIDS, particularly children. We have to take very serious steps about ensuring that we cut back both on mother-to-child transmission, for which medicines fortunately now exist, as well as ensuring that victims are protected, that where people can be cured, they get medication, and where people pass away, that their families are protected. And we haven't yet got the structures there to take care of that. So it's a serious issue. I'm glad you flagged it.
China?
You want to say something, Robert?
I think in the cities, they're making a real effort. And the Chinese are starting to produce some antiretrovirals. I think the problem in China is that you've got great mobility of people, and that which they can do in the city is very, very hard for them to do out in the villages and out in the counties, so that even if they have a good education program in Shanghai, it doesn't help that much as people are moving back and forth insofar as the transmission of AIDS. I'm talking about education as the first line of defense. No, I think it's a tremendous problem. I think the Chinese are underreporting it.
My name is Don Call, and I'm sort of interested in the fact that over an hour has now gone by, and in the contrast between India and China, the issue of religion has never been mentioned. If you take India, about 1 billion people, which is about 700,000 Hindu, about 300,000 Muslim, you've never seen a country where religion is more a part of everyday life. There are gods, there are shrines. Everyone is into this every day of their life. You can't drive down the road without seeing a shrine with cars lined up and people stopping for a few minutes, dropping a few coins, a little prayer, and they go on. And yet you contrast that with China, roughly the same size, maybe a little bit bigger, and with as benign a movement as the Falun Gong, which really wasn't a religious movement, just completely crushed by the government and treated as a tremendous threat to the government. And I'm just wondering if we could get some comment on that.
Sure. Comments about religious freedom and the implications for what's in store for both countries.
Well, I would say, you know, in China, there is a huge spiritual hunger aloft in the land these days. It was a hunger that was met in a way by Mao as a kind of godhead way back when. And you see manifestations of it. People are joining home churches, Christian churches, Tibetan Buddhism, Falun Gong. And the problem is, simply put, is this: that the party does not take kindly to any independent institutions, which is why they eschew a relationship with the Holy See and the Vatican, because the Vatican wants to appoint bishops, and China will not allow that. They want their churches under the party's control. They would like all religion, all institutions under the party's control. This is changing, but grudgingly and reluctantly. So there is this huge home church movement. I don't know where it'll all go, but religion is a very personal thing. It is the personification of the individual having a relationship to whatever God is of her or his choice. And this is something China's not accustomed to. It's written into the party constitution that if you're a party member, you have to be an atheist. So these habits die slowly. They are dying, but it's part of this whole incredible evolution to what? And nobody knows the answer to that, to what? And you can ask that question in religion. What's the official position? Not clear.
Don, I want to thank you for picking that up, because you really answered the question from Orville. Are there other things we can add to the list of similarities and dissimilarities? And certainly religion is one of them. Here.
Hi, I actually have to thank the person who gave a question before me here. I was going to give the AIDS question as well, but my triple threat is the rapid growth in population. And one thing that hadn't been brought up is the number of people moving into unplanned settlements in large urban areas. Mm-hmm. There's going to be the threat being that with this massive growth in both India and China, that the separation of wealth will grow, and that will create civil unrest within countries. Not to put too much blame on the UN, because I don't think that they're a part of this, but I believe that the Millennium Development Goals are failing terribly and not addressing these issues, and I'd like to see what the panelists would think, would respond to that.
Well, I mean, when we say the UN's Millennium Development Goals are failing, we're making a very valid point about what governments are failing to do to fulfill their commitments, to provide the resources necessary to fulfill some of these goals. There is no question, of course, that the issue of human settlements is vital. And I've seen in India the rapid urbanization, and it's not particularly successful urbanization in many parts. We went from, 15 years ago, I think, a country that was just 20% urban. It's now about 35% and will, within the next 15 years, be 50% urban. And that, given the size of our population, places an intolerable burden on the infrastructures of cities. So you're right to flag it. I'm happy to say people are conscious of this. How much the planners can do in the face of the pressure of numbers remains to be seen. Indeed, India has, as you know, some of the largest urban slums in the world, and this is something that India has been struggling with even before this phenomenon just got worse.
In the China area?
I guess I'd answer it in two ways. I think there already is a challenge for migrant worker communities within some of the major cities. Do they have access, except, you know, through private donations and efforts, you know, to education for their children? Do they have access to, you know, any of the infrastructure, plumbing, this kind of thing? No. You know, do construction workers go unpaid for a year and then end up protesting? Yes, all of this is happening. But the Chinese have on the books plans to urbanize 300 million people between 2000 and 2020. That's roughly the size of, you know, population in the United States, which is really extraordinary. That means, again, tremendous infrastructure development and the opportunity to get it right, right? Will they? I don't know. I think it's going to be very locally dependent. When you have a proactive, you know, mayor or provincial governor, then maybe you're going to see some things done right. But I think, you know, Chinese are very, very creative people. And in Shanghai, I was talking to somebody who was visiting me as a professor at Fudan University, which is in Shanghai, and we're talking about the car situation in Shanghai. Shanghai has tried diligently, the local government, to limit the number of cars. And they were overruled by the Ministry of Commerce, which said it is the right of every Chinese to own a car. That was funny. But more than that...
We like
that. Yeah. Some people here will like that. Anyway, but more than that, I think... the way they get around it, they tried to set the license fee. In Beijing, it costs maybe, what, $400 or something equivalent, $400 to get a license for your car. In Shanghai, it's like $4,000 or even more, maybe $6,000, as much as it costs to buy one of the cheaper cars, it costs to get a license. But what do the people do? What did this professor do? They just go to Jiangsu. They register right outside the city. So that all those efforts to try to think through urban planning and all this are completely undermined by the fact that you can go right outside the city limits, register your car for, you know, $400 or $500. So I think that even more in some ways than the challenge of these migrant populations, I think how China does this urbanization, this development, how it manages it is going to be critical.
Let's try to get a question over here.
Hi, my question is about democratization in China. And I had two questions. One is how well you thought that could address problems with accountability and corruption, and two, sort of what the state of it in China is.
Democratization in China.
Well, I mean, there's a democratization at the village level in terms of village elections, which are fairly advanced. They tend to be sort of non-party, and I think they are implemented as much to regain control of the villages as growing out of the Communist Party's deep and abiding faith in democracy. So there's a kind of a double reason. I think they're very reluctant to see these kinds of democratic institutions and ideas run away with themselves. And you see this most obviously in the media, which is much more open in many ways and diverse. On the other hand, it's still very much under the control of the propaganda department and the information office of the State Council, et cetera. So that they're very ambivalent about this. And the government, I think, it's not that they don't like democracy. They're very, very worried of what will happen to their one-party rule, which they see as the key to maintaining stability if they start opening up a lot of democratic reform efforts. And I think they have every right to be concerned, frankly, although I'm a Democrat at heart. How do you get to where India is? I don't think China can get there without completely breaking apart. That's the problem. They have this system. It's symbolically very hard to democratize in a system where a small amount of disturbance sends a massive psychological shock through everybody and everybody's state of mind, that the system is failing, coming to an end, sort of end of dynasty. That's the dilemma they're in.
Fascinating. Question here?
Bill Thawett from Booz Allen Hamilton. We've done some research that's shown that China, as you had mentioned before, has done a lot of international investment, especially in South America. Given that the U.S. policies are usually driven by where their economic interests are, what kind of potential future tension could their investment in South America create with the United States?
I think there have been concerns raised within the U.S. government about the sort of growing Chinese presence, and you know the fact that now you know Venezuela is adopting Chinese military doctrine or whatever, and some of these countries are you know adopting the PLA uniforms, and you know there's a lot of military capacity development going on. It's not just a matter of the investment, but I think that. If you look just a little bit further down the road, I think China is going to face many of the same problems that the United States and Europe faced. And that is to say that there will be resentment among local populations. You can see it already happening because when the Chinese have gone into Africa, for example, you know, all those low-interest loans, well, those low-interest loans are often tied to those tens of thousands of Chinese construction workers, right? And so they have to use part of those loans to pay for the workers. Those workers come in, and they live in guest houses that are run by Chinese. They eat in Chinese restaurants. They have really Chinese communities and that are almost self-sufficient and self-sustaining. And there is already feeling among many communities that the Chinese are not really contributing to the local development, to the local economies, to the overall wealth of the people of the country. So I think we'll see some of that taking place. I think it's entirely possible that the Chinese will act with, you know, a heavy hand. And I think there will be broken promises. I think that's the other problem. Already there's a lot of discussion within Latin America about where is all that investment that the Chinese promised? How much of it has actually, when Hu Jintao went in, when you go 2004, 2005, I guess, when he took that big trip, and they had $1 billion of investments promised in Argentina and Brazil and Chile, where is all that money? Or the support for Brazil for the Security Council seat, or all these kinds of trades that seem to be made in these grand visits and things that maybe aren't all being fulfilled. But I do think that there's concern within the U.S. government about exactly what role China is playing and what role it will play, and why China's there. I mean, why does China need to do military, sort of mill-to-mill relations with the countries of Latin America, outside of Cuba?
Good.
I think it's somewhat disingenuous to suggest that China is trying to project a military presence in South America. I guess anything is possible. But I think China has an awful lot to do internally and on its own borders. Countries like that was where we went in and bought them on the cheap through massive corruption. So I think we have to look at this two ways, you know? And by the way, if China gets Venezuelan oil, that doesn't hurt us, because there's only so much oil. So they won't be buying the oil from somewhere else. They'll be getting it from Venezuela. But I don't want to go on that.
I disagree with what you just said. That wasn't my point. I think you misunderstood.
No, I thought you were saying that they were trying to project themselves militarily into South
America. Asking the question of why they're doing capacity building in the militaries in Latin America. So maybe on that point we disagree. But I think on everything else, in terms of the role model that the United States and Europe have set in the past, I think we agree. You know, we've been no model.
Unfortunately, I think we have time for one more question, and we're on this side of the room.
Lucky me. I'm Melanie Sturm from Aspen, Colorado. And one of the things that I learned in the six years that I worked at the World Bank is that one of the key markers of development is the status of women in a society and in a country. And my husband and I embarked on the process to adopt a Chinese baby girl several months ago, and I've not only become acquainted with Chinese bureaucracy, I've also become acquainted with American bureaucracy in that effort. But in the process, I've done a little research, and my question has to do both with the status of women in China. I'd be interested to know your comments on that. But it's quite clear that one of the reasons why there are primarily baby girls available for adoption is because baby boys are much more valued in that society, and it has resulted in a very large differential in the numbers of boys and girls in the demographic 40 and under. In fact, I understand it's 40 million differential. So I'd be interested to know your views on the status of women, but also secondly, what is going to be the impact of this very serious differential in the number of men and women with respect to the growth of the economy and the society at large?
Takers?
Well, I think the disparity between the number of girl babies and boy babies is exacerbated by the fact that the social welfare net of old, which took care of elderly people, has broken down. And it means now that the household, the family, has to be the social welfare net. And boys stay in the family, and girls marry out. And thus, the traditional kind of emphasis on boys as being the Confucian sort of patrilineal descent of the family name is now gotten a new economic imperative that mitigates against families wanting to have babies in a one-child policy situation. So that makes things quite difficult. You know, I would say as to the status of women, it's a whole large topic. But one interesting piece of it is NGOs. I mean, traditionally, issues like this are lofted by NGOs. Environment would be another one. There are other civil rights, these sorts of things. China has a very ambivalent relationship with NGOs. They are proliferating, but there still is no legal basis for an NGO to exist free and clear and independently in China. And the party's very reluctant to allow that to happen. So that has some effect, I think, on the ability of issues that the state itself has a limited capacity to handle to evolve through civil society.
So I'm afraid that's the last word, but let me help and thank the panel for helping us understand what's in store.